Hello, dear ones, and welcome back to another episode of the podcast. I'm crossing my fingers this weekend that I'll be able to get two episodes out to you. We'll see what happens, but here is the first one, and it is with my guest, Brian Height. This podcast has talked about synchronicity before, and certainly I have had some guests come on that detail these gorgeous events in their lives, one right after the other, that lead them to exactly where they need to be. And that's the gist of Brian's story this week. It's really a fabulous one. And I kind of loved listening to Brian's explanation about how so many things unfurled in his life to get him to where he is today. And you know, I'm actually living my life like that right now. I'm not sure how many of you know that I don't have a place to live and that my life is sort of up in the air at this point. And I'm following sign to sign, synchronicity to synchronicity, and really feeling like the universe is in conversation with me, telling me to be patient and telling me that all will work out. And so I'm living proof. I am living proof that you can live, albeit a little outside society's norms. I'm proof that you can live and follow the messages, follow the signs, and live a life that feels authentic, that feels real, that feels good. Sometimes I think I might be a little too passive waiting for the signs, but sooner rather than later, I get up off my butt and I get back in the game. So anyway, Brian is really an incredible person and his life has been very interesting. He's been a stuntman forever, and that kind of blends in with his story of synchronicity that he talks about. He's done Hollywood and beyond. He has over 100 film and television credits, and he's a master resilience trainer for the U.S. Army. He actually spent a decade teaching soldiers how to reframe their perceptions of challenges. But actually, these days, Brian is known as the High Stakes Performance Whisperer because he's an expert in transforming how individuals and organizations perceive and navigate high-stakes environments. I mean, we need more people like that in this world. And all right, that's it for my intro right now. Here's my conversation with Brian Height.
For me, the magical thing is how that process connects over time. So when I think about just all the little things that had to happen, and I can go back a long way, but I'll just go back to high school where I happened to end up in a drama class. And that drama class, we did some kind of show and the drama teacher, I ran the lights. So that was another thing. I don't know. They just said, Brian, you should do some lights. I said, all right, that's cool. So I did that. And then from that, this drama teacher knew a guy who worked at a theme park. Opryland was in Nashville back in the day. Now it's a mall, but it was the theme park back then with shows. And he knew a guy who was a lighting designer there. And he's introduced us. And the guy got me a job as a technician at a show out there.
A human being. If you had to go to a conference or a party and you had to introduce yourself to a group of people, how would you do that?
Well, I get asked to introduce myself to a group of people a lot. And it's funny because I don't know how to answer that question. Usually in our culture, it's what do you do? That's what we equate ourselves to. What do you do? Well, I do a lot of things and I don't know how to put all that into one package. But I'll tell you, over the last maybe year, it's been easier. I'm getting there. It's one of the things that I'm intentionally trying to do is to really bring together these different aspects of me, the stuntman part, the sport performance psychologist part, the dad part, the academic part with faculty member, just bringing together all of these different things in a way that makes sense as one package, as opposed to waking up today or even just going throughout the day and asking, okay, well, what hat am I wearing right now? I don't know. Who am I right now? Am I the stunt guy or am I the the coach, or am I the speaker? Like, what am I doing? So it's a hard question to answer because there are so many different components. I'd say overall, I just try to live, just who am I as a person, is somebody who just tries to live by the things that I think are important, which for me is curiosity and growth and interest and engagement with life and others. That for me is what makes life worth doing. And so that's it. That would be my answer to that one.
Thank you for that. And I'm just, you know, based on the vocation that, you know, you brought up stuntman, but were you, as a kid, did you imagine this was what you were going to do? How did this come about?
It came about because I had no idea what I was going to do. I've spent my entire, well, that's not true. There was a while that I wanted to be a fighter pilot, and I was in high school. I'd looked at going to the Air Force Academy, but then it turned out that I had astigmatism and they weren't going to let me fly a fighter plane. So then that was out the window. And from that point on, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I knew that I was supposed to graduate from high school and go to college because that was just what was expected. So that's what I did. I went to Rutgers in New Jersey and spent the first 2 years asking that exact question. What am I supposed to do? What am I going to be when I grow up? I have no idea. And then I saw the live stunt show at the Six Flags in New Jersey. So while I was at college, I had a friend who was the company manager of the Batman stunt show at the Six Flags in New Jersey. And he gave me some tickets to the park. I went out to see the show and was just floored. I was, that was it. I mean, that's where I found it. It just, from the minute the first explosion happened and the motorcycles came jumping out of this thing, that's what I want to do. So I was able to go backstage and talk to the people and say, you know, how do you get this job? And they said, well, you got to know how to do fights and high falls and motorcycles, none of which I knew how to do. And I didn't even know what it was, really. And I learned it. I auditioned. I got the job the next year. And from that point, then I did know what I wanted to do. But it had nothing to do with college. And so that's why I dropped out of college the first time. I left to go to LA to be a stuntman. The sport performance psychology part, that never entered my mind. I mean, as a kid or I mean, it was just even when I was going through the graduate programs, it wasn't something that was on my radar as something that I would ever do as a job. It was just interesting information. I'd been coaching gymnastics. I'd seen how these kids would be just very, very different performers at practice versus competitions. That intrigued me. I started to learn more and I just continued to learn more. And what I was learning was applicable to me as a stuntman. It was immediately applicable in a real world setting. And that was it. That was the extent of it. It wasn't for a job. So all of these things. And then, you know, author, if you'd have told me even 5 years ago that I was going to write a book or that would be something I'd even be interested in doing, I'd have told you were crazy. Now I've got, I don't know, four of them in various stages of done, along with the one that's finished. Speaking, I remember being terrified in fifth grade about an oral report on sharks. I remember it vividly because I was so scared. And now I speak for a living. And so none of this was anything that was an early, like, this is what I'm going to be. I'm going to go be in front of people. I'm going to perform. I'm going to be in this world of put yourself out there. I, at no point in my youngness did that ever come out. It has just sort of emerged from the age of 20 on in the various paths that it has. And that's what I'm saying is so cool about right now, is that those paths have been very divergent from 20 of I'm going to do stunts to, okay, now I'm going back to college to, okay, now I've got this job. Okay, now I'm going to start writing. Very different. Now they're all starting to come back together again into this one brand, this one path that I can really take advantage of all of those things that I've learned to love and move forward in that direction.
I'm ever so curious, when you came back after that show, that initial show with that your friend got you access to, and you had made this decision and you told your parents, what was their reaction?
Well, I told one of my parents because I didn't want to experience the reaction of the other one. I told my mom what was happening. And she, you know, she reacted mostly the way you would expect parents to, although she's always been one of, okay, well, if this is what you're going to do, you're going to go do your own thing. And if that's what you want, then go ahead. Now, my dad, again, after 3.5 years at college, I'd left with one semester to go. I dropped out. Now, obviously, I ended up going back and finishing it and getting the master's and a PhD on top of it. But at the time, nobody knew that. Nobody had a crystal ball. It was just Brian dropping out of college after 3.5 years of time and money. And so, yeah, I don't know if I'd have been a fly on the wall when that got communicated from my mom to my dad. Don't know. I can imagine. Don't know what all that was. But yeah, I avoided that direct confrontation.
You know, I've interviewed a few other people who have been stunt men and women on the show, and it's been fascinating. When they were younger and they decided to pursue it, they were so just gung-ho. And they're like, I'm going to do the high fall. I'm going to do the car. I'm going to do this and this. And then later on, maybe 20, 25 years later, maybe they're faced with something similar and they think, good God, what was I thinking? Have you had that moment yet in your life?
No, it's funny. I go the other way. Like, I was working on the new Superman movie this past summer, and while I was out there, I was working. It was a great sequence with a lot of cool stuff and people flying all over the place, and we're trying to shoot it in one. So there was a lot just over and over wrecking throughout this whole thing, and the people running it weren't like my friend was one of the stunt coordinators on there, and he knew what I could do, you know. And I'm 50. I'm out there working with, I don't know, 25-year-olds. People truly half my age out there doing these things. And the other stunt coordinators, I hadn't worked with them before. And when you don't know somebody as a stunt coordinator, it's you don't really put them into situations where they may end up getting hurt, where they can make you look bad, et cetera. So I ended up getting put in the background. They're like, yeah, run around. You just fall. The thing hits you, you know, fall down, whatever. Just easy stuff. And I kept asking, I could do that. Do you guys need me to get ratcheted and bounce off of this thing? I'm happy to do that. So I've gone the other way, is that as I get older, I recognize that there are only so many more car hits that I'm going to be able to do, that there's going to be a last one, that there's going to be a last stair fall. I'm working on a TV show called The Cleaning Lady next week, and I'm doing a fight on this sailboat that's up on a trailer. And I get knocked off of the sailboat and I fall and clip a picnic table and go to the ground. It's about 10 feet from the sailboat to the ground. There's only going to be so many more times that I can do that. And so I embrace and look forward to and take advantage of any opportunity to actually do stunts that I have, because there's going to come a day when my body's not going to be able to take it anymore. And stunt coordinators just aren't going to trust me to do those things anymore. So I look for and really am grateful for any of the chances to still do that stuff that I can.
I'm going to date myself a little bit, but were you kind of a daredevil as a kid? Like, did you ever watch Jackass and think, oh, I'm going to do that. That sounds like a good idea. Or I could do something, but take it up a notch. Were you like that as a kid, kind of taking chances?
Yeah. The Jackass thing, I never watched that. That actually came out when I was a stuntman, and their whole attitude it's just incredibly different from how stunt people approach things. For those out there that they may not, that typically people think about stunt people as, oh my God, you're crazy. How do you do? Like, we're not crazy. That's how we're still walking around. We approach the things that are dangerous, that are risky, and we will do them, but we assess the risk and we evaluate the extent to which we believe that we're capable of interacting with that risk in a way that allows us to walk away safely at the end, just like anybody else does. Life is a probability. There's no guarantee that we're going to walk out the front door safely. So there are just certain levels of risk that we are willing to accept given what our capabilities and resources are. And stunt people are no different. So when I was a kid, it was the same kind of thing. Yeah, I would do risky things. I would do things that pushed the limit, things that challenged my abilities at the time. And I loved it, and I still do. So, but again, I don't know that that's different from so many other people. It's just where that threshold of acceptable levels of risk is. I think we may define that differently, but it's still the same process of, okay, well, this is something that I believe I can do safely or it isn't. And if it isn't, then I'm not going to do it.
Yes, I remember I watched a documentary film on early stunts, and I first of all have an insane fear of heights, like one that I just want to throw up everywhere if I get anywhere too high. And there was this black and white clip of this man, and you can tell he's up high because you can see the city of New York way in the distance, and he's on this girder, and there is nothing keeping him on that girder. There are no safety lines. There's nothing underneath him. And I don't think a lot of people know that the history, you know, the early history of doing stunts was fraught with accidents and injuries and people dying. And so I'm grateful these days that I'm sure there are second and third ways of keeping everyone safe. So I will never climb up that high on a skyscraper, let alone get on a iron girder and walk out to the edge. That's all.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, you know, I mean, yes, there are safety precautions in place and the stuff is still dangerous. You know, I mean, if it weren't, there would be no need for stunt people. So yes, there are some precautions and some different safety measures that certainly people have learned over the years, or different ways to shoot things that make it that lessen the risk that people are taking. But I'll tell you, it's funny what you said, because when people ask me, sometimes they'll ask me, like, what's the craziest stunt you ever did? Or what was the time when you were just, like, scared or whatever it was? And depending on how they word it, the answer that I give is different. But one of the things that does come up sometimes, and it's just, I tell them, like, this doesn't sound like a big deal, but this was one of the times that I was scaredest in my career. In fact, I think it was the time that I was probably the most afraid. I was working on a TV show called Numbers. And I was doubling a guy, and I was running across a roof, and the stunt was the roof was kind of crazy. So running across that, but the stunt was jumping up onto the ledge like of the roof. So the roof was flat, but then it had about a, I don't know, maybe 2 foot high ledge with a platform on it of maybe a foot, you know, a foot wide, that just went all the way around the edge of the thing. So I was supposed to run, jump up the two feet and land on the 2 foot thing and just stand there with my arms out. And that wasn't a hard thing to do. It's something, you know, could do over and over again. And I did that day. I did do a few times. But the thing that made it so hard was that I was 50 feet up on the up off the ground over concrete with nothing attaching me to anything. So if I were to jump up on this ledge and catch a toe, or just, I don't know, overshoot it for whatever reason, or get off balance, I was going face first to the concrete, and that would have been probably the end of Brian, because it was a long way down. And there are times when you can do things that where it absolutely does lessen the risk that's there, but it's rarely eliminated completely. Again, just like regular life.
Thank you for sharing that. Again, like, I would have not gone near that ledge just because it was high. I would have looked at it and stood way far back. Even probably watching you do that stunt would have made me vomit everywhere. So that's how bad it is. Well, I'd love to ask the second question, which is, did you grow up in a religious household, and how did that kind of maybe change or stay the same for you as you got older?
No, I didn't grow up in a religious household. My parents, I guess, nominally were Christians, Protestants. They tried to take me to church for a while. I don't remember exactly when my behavior at church made that not happen anymore, but I was happy when it did, because I hated it. It was so boring. And So religion was not a part of my growing up at all, but it was and has been stuff that has interested me over the years. I've read a ton. I've read the New Testament several times. I've read parts of the Old Testament, never read the whole thing. I've read the Bhagavad Gita. I've read the Upanishads, Hindu texts. I've read the Tao Te Ching, so the Taoist text, some Buddhist texts here and there. I have not read the Quran or any parts of that. So, but I've read a lot in the fields of religion, and particularly in Christianity. And I've gone up and down. There was a time in my life where I was atheist and I went to agnostic, and then I went to, okay, I'm Christian, and then I'm agnostic again. And I think now I'm at the agnostic place where I'm humble enough as a human being to realize I don't know all that there is, and I can't say with certainty anything truly, really anything, that anything is certain. So that's where the agnosticism comes in. But in my mind, I'm not operating under the assumption that there's any kind of God that anybody has any access to or understanding of, and certainly that has dictated any kind of prescriptive way of living life on this particular planet. So that's where I am with that process right now. And again, my book is called Begin Again, Utilize the Wisdom of Eastern and Western Ideologies to Achieve Your Full Potential. That came from Western science, that came from Western philosophy, it came from Western religions with Judaism. Well, again, except for Islam, because although there is a lot of overlap with that one and Christianity and Judaism in terms of the origin, it splits pretty quick off of there. And I'm not familiar with what their teachings are in that one. But the Eastern religions too, like I said, with the Buddhism and the Hinduism, Shintoism, I haven't gotten into too much, but I have tried to at least sample a little bit of all of that. And the thing that's really, that keeps me coming back to it is just, it's the wisdom that's really there. You know, I don't know that God prescribed anything, like I said before, but what is written and what these people, how they were thinking and the types of problems that they were processing and really truly trying to understand at a deep level are still problems that we wrestle with today. And the perspectives that come from these different sides are really, have been helpful for me at any rate to consider and to take into account while living my own life.
Thank you for that. That's so interesting. You know, I went to seminary and I haven't even read all of everything that you've read. I mean, I've read a lot of things that you would never want to read, like infant baptism during the Protestant Reformation in the 1600s. Definitely stay away from that book. All of your books sound so much better. I just am really intrigued. Why did you kind of take all these different avenues? Like, did these books call to you? Was there something that you were looking for, some sort of question you were trying to answer? Or you just naturally, do you have a curious mind?
Yeah, I absolutely have a curious mind. I subscribe to philosophy now. That's what kind of geek I am. I just, the deeper questions of how did we get here, and is there a purpose, and do we even have free will? I mean, there are some really challenging questions that are just fun to talk about and fun to think about. I don't know that human beings are even built in such a way as to be capable of fully understanding anything. I mean, just even our sensory perception, there's only a certain range of light waves that we can perceive. And there are only a certain number of, you know, range of sound waves that we can perceive that even make it into our awareness. The world is so much bigger, and how we experience it is filtered through the limitations of human beings. So I don't know that it's even possible to understand everything. And so that, even for me, that adds to the funness of, okay, well, what are we missing? What's possibly out there? And is there another way? You know, until the telescope was invented, we didn't know anything of what was going on out in space, just what we could see with our eyes. Until the microscope was invented, things that were beyond what we could see didn't exist. People made fun of people talking about germs when they first came out, you know? So the deep questions are ones that I really enjoy. And reading authors like Plato and Socrates and Aristotle and, Socrates through Plato, because he didn't really write anything, but then some of the Stoic philosophers, Marcus Aurelius, Seneca, and then again, the Eastern philosophy, the Tao Te Ching is amazing. The Upanishads have so much wisdom within there. And so does the Bible. I mean, looking through the Old Testament in particular, that spans thousands of years. And they're asking such amazing questions. And when you look at the Bible as a whole, as Israel's story being told, then it becomes even more interesting, because you've got things like 1 and 2 Samuels and 1 and 2 Kings, 1, 2, 3 Kings. I don't remember which one has three, But Samuel and Kings, that's telling the story one way. And then you've got Chronicles coming right after it, literally right after it, telling the exact same story, but in a different way. Even some of the specific situations, they're different. They're put in there differently. So that begs the question, well, the person, somebody put them together and it wasn't an accident. They did it on purpose. So let's not argue about whether this happened or that happened or what the true history was of what. Let's get at what the guy was trying to say. What was the message that he was trying to send by including these things in the Bible in the first place and in the order in which they were preserved? So through that, I think we can learn a lot about the wisdom of who we are and how we can tell our own stories through these books and through the lenses that these other really, really smart, really wise, really deep thinkers have considered this universe.
That was a beautiful, gorgeous answer, really thoughtful, but you brought up philosophy. So I have to ask, because this is so interesting to me, which philosophical, or it could be more than one, which philosophical line of thought do you ascribe to? Which resonates most deeply for you? Is, you know, like I have a dear friend, Stoicism is like her jam. And so I'm so curious if you have one that really speaks to you.
Well, I've read a lot of the Stoics. I've read some of Epictetus, like I said, Marcus Aurelius. I've read almost all of Seneca's works. So I've read a lot of the Stoics. And I think that what's interesting about that is Stoicism coincides in a really weird way with cognitive theory in psychology. So, you know, again, I've spent a lot of time studying psychology with the master's in sports psychology, PhD in organizational psychology, and both of those fields tend to lean very heavily on cognitive theory, which emerged in the 50s with, nobody needs a history on all that, but the 50s through the 60s and 70s. And then, but it's still a very big thing, cognitive behavioral. You hear those all the time with different therapies. Well, it's the same thing at its core as Stoicism, which is, I mean, Epictetus says it, Marcus Aurelius says it. It's not things that mess us up. It's how we interpret those things. It's our judgment and perception of those things that really matters. That's what it is that our reality is generated from. It's not the things themselves. We can interpret those in any number of ways. It's how we choose to interpret it, because it's kind of like quantum theory. You know, if you think about quantum theory, there's this wave function of probability, and the particle could be anywhere in there. That to me is a situation. Situation is the same as a wave function. But then when the particle is observed and we become, okay, no, the wave function has collapsed. It's now at this one place. This is reality. That's how our perception is of that situation. The situation doesn't become real or even meaningful until we assign meaning to it. But that meaning could be anything. It's up to us to determine that. And that's really what Stoicism is saying. And that's the same thing with cognitive psychology. It really gets at the heart of what we're thinking, how we are thinking, the patterns of thinking, how those perceptions come into being, and really developing an awareness of that and how those patterns of thinking are affecting our emotional state, our interactions with others, and ultimately our life as a whole. So Stoicism is very similar to that. But I also, you know, existentialism, I think, is something that's an interesting philosophy. I think Sartre had a lot of things right with that, with, you know, just the idea of there's not really a big whole purpose or whatever. It's the purpose of life is what we make of it. But there is one. It's not a nihilistic way of looking at things of we're all just out here and just banging around for whatever. And it's all like Albert Camus, you know, it's all just absurd. We're just sort of whatever we are. There's still meaning. There's meaning. In fact, there's more meaning because there's not this ultimate big purpose or big place or end state. It makes it even more meaningful than that, because we are finite creatures and every moment counts so much, and we get to make of those moments what we want. So that philosophical approach has been one that has spoken to me as well. And I got to tell you, this is funny too, because my birthday was on Saturday, and I'd never liked birthdays. It's just, I don't like the attention. I'm an introvert, and it's not my thing. I definitely don't want any parties or anything like that. So I made that clear to my fiance and my kids. We have 9, 11, and 12. And so what we did, and because they wanted to celebrate, so we couldn't just ignore it. So I said, all right, here's the compromise. We're going to have DAO Celebration Day. That's what it's going to be. T-A-O, the DAO. And so obviously the kids didn't know what that was. And I explained to them that the DAO is just, it's everything. It is everything all around. It's not a thing. It is all things, and all things are incorporated in it. It all flows, and it is, and it's just the present moment. There is no future. The DAO is just now. And I try to explain all that, because that's another philosophy that I really think makes a lot of sense. To me, it just, especially when you start looking at even the Western science, and again, the quantum physics or just physics as a whole, of the fact that matter and energy, like Einstein said, are identical. They're the same. They're just different forms of the same thing. So, and it's always in motion, and it's always changing. And the Buddhist philosophy of impermanence, you know, that idea of impermanence with it, and it's all changing. Nothing's permanent. So to answer your question, there's not one, there's a big mixture of them. That's one of the things I love. I love taking from all of that stuff. And whatever's really speaking to me at that moment that I can feel connected with what I experience in my life, that's what I gravitate toward.
Just because I want to know, because it's one of my favorites, what do you think of depth psychology and Carl Jung? Have you done any kind of, made any forays into that kind of universe?
No, the Carl Jung, I don't know much about it, so I'm not even going to pretend to. I have a very surface level intro to psychology, because I had to learn it and I had to teach it at one point. But yeah, Carl Jung's idea that there's this collective intelligence, that there's a connection among all people, and that there's this sum of just everybody's connected. I think that there's certainly a way to see that. I don't know that the way that Jung explained it is necessarily the way that I would see it, but there's no doubt. I mean, there's no arguing that all of energy is connected. That even I think I'm sitting in a chair right now, and from a human perspective, I am. But from an energy perspective, if we were to really break this down of where all the particles are and how they're moving and what everything's relation to what, it's just one system that's happening. And that's Jung's idea of intelligence and collective intelligence at a higher level. But yeah, the psychoanalytic stuff that Jung was kind of in the same vein as, or at least presented to me in school, in the same vein as Freud, who was crazy, and most of his stuff. I mean, again, smart guy, real good writer, but his ideas were out there, and very little scientific evidence backing any of them up anymore. So anyway, that's where I'm at with that one.
It would have helped if Freud wasn't addicted to cocaine. I think we can all agree on that. That, you know, tends to skew perception maybe just a little bit. I wanted to just ask, before we get to the main question of the podcast, I think this is very interesting. You were bringing up sports psychology earlier and how, you know, people during practice can be very different than when they're actually, you know, they are called to show up, perform, maybe in front of, I don't know, family and friends, maybe in front of 1,000 people, maybe in front of the world. What struck me was, I feel like that kind of work can also be translated to us, you know, doing our work, you know, let's say as writers, right? You know, here we are, we're writing in our rooms or at work, but then we have to put those things out into the world for other people to see or kind of judge. It feels like the sports psychology can apply to so very many different things in that respect.
Yeah, it's applicable to a lot of things. And in fact, it's interesting that you brought it up that way. One of the things that in the discovery calls that I do with all of my clients, particularly the athletes, although, I mean, I also work with organizations and businesses and performers of all kinds. But when I talk to the clients or potential clients at that point during the discovery call, I make it very clear to them that I'm happy if they win their medals or their trophies or whatever it is, but that isn't the point of what it is that I would be working with them toward. That the objective that I have is bigger than that. I think that the skills and concepts and techniques that we explore during the coaching are ones that absolutely, if they apply them in their athletic environment, they will see benefit from and probably maximize the likelihood of achieving their goals or medals or ribbons or what have you. But that's just the medium for practicing those things. That's just the place where you get to rehearse and really gain proficiency in the use of these concepts and skills, because it's regular life where they become most applicable and most helpful. Because just like anything, I mean, the mental skills that we develop are skills. They're just, you know, there was a time when we, all of us, we can do something now that we couldn't do it back then. So just like that, some skill that we used to not be able to do it, now we can do it. How did we learn to do it? Well, we did learn to do it, and we practiced doing it, and we continued to practice until we gained proficiency. And if we want to keep that proficiency, we continue to practice still. And that's the way that mental skills are. They're skills just the same way. So I love athletics, or really any type of performance setting, particularly for kids, where they can have this place that's really a targeted, safe place to practice these different things, to implement them, to introduce the idea of, okay, well, what are you thinking? What are you feeling? Let's name that emotion. Let's talk about where it might be coming from. What are you seeing right now? And how are you seeing it? Can you explain that to me of what your perception is? And so that they start to develop that awareness, because then when they're out in the world having the argument with a significant other, or having some disagreement with their parent, or, you know, in some kind of conflict with a peer over, should I do this or should I not do that? They can have that awareness that they've developed in this other setting. They can apply some of these same skills in those moments and see benefit from it. So I really do emphasize to all of my clients that although this, whatever it is that you are here for, and you're coming to me because you want to do better at this particular area in this particular thing, we're going to work through that, and we're going to use that thing as the platform from which to launch to higher levels. So we're going to use this place that you've just come to me in to learn, to practice, to develop these skills. And then we'll talk about how they generalize out to other areas of your life. Because for me, that's where the benefit really is. That's where the goodness lies. It's not in simply achieving more in a narrow performance setting. It's learning the qualities, characteristics, techniques, and abilities to just broaden out and be able to function in as resilient and in as just a way that is indicative of our potential as possible in all situations.
You've been witness to this a lot longer than I have, just by based on the work that you're doing, but I kind of sense that kids are harder on themselves now than they have been in the past as far as performance and success. Is that true, or what are your thoughts around that?
I don't know that kids are any harder on themselves now than before. I don't know. I mean, I haven't read anything that would lead me to believe that. Just from my own experience, I was pretty hard on myself when I didn't achieve what I wanted to achieve as I was coming up through the ranks of kidhood. But it really comes down to an environment. You know, I mean, the kids are going to care about what we tell them to care about, and not even what we tell them to care about, but what we model caring about. So we can say that teamwork and trying hard and effort and all these things are what really matter. But then when we get all upset and flustered and make a big deal out of losing a game or a mistake on the field, or, you know, I mean, just even out in the world of work, if there's a boss who says, you know what we really want is just everybody come together, everybody bring their full selves, but then get upset because some presentation went bad or a client got lost or something like that. you know, it we're gonna pay more attention to what people actually do. That's how we're gonna judge what matters and what doesn't, rather than what people say. So that's a place where I think that there's a disconnect often between the messages that kids are being told and the messages that they are actually receiving from parents, from coaches, from leaders, teachers, etc.
Thank you. Thanks for that. I just remember being a kid and playing soccer. And first of all, our team was horrible. It was so bad. And I was the goalie. And, you know, I think we lost this one game like 9-0 and all the balls, you know, and I mean, talk about feeling just devastated as a kid and miserable and depressed because, you know, as the goalie, I felt like I had failed. Now, keep in mind, I was in fourth grade and like had no skills whatsoever. They just put me in goalie, but I was blamed by the rest of the team too. So when you're in those positions where people perceive that, you know, like for example, at soccer, it's, you know, kids, it's your fault. All the goals went in, you know, notwithstanding everything else that went on the field to get the ball that close to me to get it in the goal, it can be really challenging to not feel beat up and not feel like take on the fact that everything's your fault. So I always think about that. Like, how can we mitigate that? How can we create resiliency? How can we help kids to understand that it's kind of a team thing, you know, and to not, mm-hmm. not take things so personally, I guess. I feel like I could talk to you forever, but we only have a few more minutes left. So I'm going to ask you the main question of the podcast, which is, I mean, this is just such a, we're veering off in another direction here rather dramatically. The main question of the podcast, because this is really also a podcast about reminding people that life has mystery, that it has hope, that it has potentials for things that are maybe inexplicable to happen in it. But the main question is, or maybe it's a statement, I don't know. I would love for you to share something that you've experienced in your life that you have felt was maybe miraculous, maybe magical, maybe even mysterious, because I've had stories of ghosts. I've had everything basically under the sun. You can't even, I mean, after, what are we on? I'm doing 215 this week episode. So I've heard so many different stories from people. And it really is about how humans create meaning with these incidents or these events that happen in their lives. But I would love to hear anything that you'd like to share. It can even be more than one story.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, it's not a story, but it's how I look at things overall. So for me, well, let me start here. So the way I think about opportunity is that it happens all the time, that opportunities present themselves usually daily. And the reason that we don't recognize or, you know, think that they happen as often as they do is because one of three things is missing. One is just having the openness to the possibility that an opportunity might arise. We may be so fixated on one direction and one type of way of viewing our circumstances that we're missing the possibilities that come our way. So we need to be open to the fact that possibilities exist. The second is flexibility, that once we recognize that these things are happening and it may be a possibility, we got to be flexible enough to shift and to move and say, all right, yeah, I was going that way, but I need to go this way. This is the better way to go. And to be able to see that flexibility and take advantage of that. And then the third, and this trips up a lot of people, is having the courage to take that first step into that unknown, into that new direction. And that's where opportunity lies, is the openness, the flexibility, and that courage to move forward. So for me, the magical thing is how that process connects over time. So when I think about just all the little things that had to happen, and I can go back a long way, but I'll just go back to high school where I happened to end up in a drama class. And that drama class, we did some kind of show and the drama teacher, I ran the lights. So that was another thing. I don't know. They just said, Brian, you should do some lights. I said, all right, that's cool. So I did that. And then from that, this drama teacher knew a guy who worked at a theme park. Opryland was in Nashville back in the day. Now it's a mall, but it was the theme park back then with shows. And he knew a guy who was a lighting designer there. And he's introduced us. And the guy got me a job as a technician at a show out there. And the company or the stage manager, my very first summer at that show, was the company manager at the Batman stunt show that I went to. And so there I am at the stunt show, and now I'm able to do stunts. And while I was skipping school during the senior year, after I'd already done the thing, I went to the golf course at Rutgers. I just went by myself to play golf. Happened to be three people in front of me, one of whom happened to be a stuntman from L.A. My plan was, after doing the stunt show in New Jersey, to go to Florida and go try to do the Indiana Jones show or whatever other stunt shows are down there. But I played golf with this guy. We spent 4 hours talking about stunts, and he said, move to L.A. And I said, OK. And I did. And through him, I started playing in the Stuntman Softball League, and I met all these other people, and my career started to take off. So it's these little things that, you know, people describe them as serendipity, or it's God's plan, or it's whatever. I don't see it as any kind of plan or anything else. I mean, I could have gone left or right, and who knows what would have happened. If life may be a whole lot better if I hadn't met the guy at the golf course, it would have been different. But I still would have been able to look back and make those connections. And I think that's part of humans. We want to make meaning of things. We want to create some sort of cohesive story. Our brains do not like ambiguity at all. It will fill in gaps regularly. And there are all kinds of studies around this, and they're very interesting about how the brain will just make up stuff to fill in the gaps of our knowledge. But that's how we think about the past. So as I do think about the past, even knowing what I just said, it's still magical to me how these series of connections, these series of seemingly random events that could have gone either way, ended up going the way that they did, and they put me right here. So there's no argument that all of those different little things all came together to make me who I am sitting here talking to you right now. And to me, that's magical. Even if it's not a plan or any kind of destiny or anything else, it's still what happened. And that to me is fascinating. So I don't know. That's just my perspective on that.
Oh, no, I absolutely love it. And, you know, there's that word synchronicity. And Carl Jung was a big proponent of the idea of synchronicity. I mean, he kind of brought it out into the world as something that we should all be mindful about and notice and understand just about how mysterious and magical this world is. And so I'll give you a little synchronistic thing. So I have not talked about Opryland in forever. Okay. Forever. And at my job the other night, a woman came in and we were talking, and she just says, oh, I worked at Opryland just 2 days ago. And so now here you are bringing up Opryland again. And when I was in high school, I was in swing choir, and they took us from Illinois, outside of Chicago, down to Opryland to perform, to sing and dance to our heart's content and compete with all these schools from all over. It was really fun. It was seriously nerve-wracking. Opryland was so fun. I loved it. But here we are. In my mind, having this conversation, I'm like, oh, synchronicity, because I have not talked about it maybe in decades. And here you are, you bring it up, and someone just brought it up 2 days ago. And so for me, that kind of weaves this really beautiful thread between your experiences, my experiences, her experiences, and kind of demonstrates that we're all connected, or there's something going on. And I love your story about, I don't know, I'm getting the idea that you're like, I stumbled into being the lighting person in high school, and then I stumbled, you know, it's all these things, but there you really met these people along the way that almost, I don't know, ushered or invited you to take these other paths in life. And it's gotten you to where you are today. And for me, I think that's absolutely gorgeous. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. It's I would not have gone the way that I did or be where I am if it weren't for these people. And certainly when I met one, it made it more likely that I was going to meet the other ones, because it's a whole different circle. So there's a probabilistic nature of the whole path too. But it's still, it's like I said, looking back, it is interesting to see all of those connections. I don't see them as, again, any kind of divine plan or anything. I think that but it is still, it is a weird connection. Not weird. It's just a connection. It's interesting when you see how all the things come together and how all the people, and I agree with you. I think that if more people really embraced the connectedness among everybody, that we truly, this is the thing about, and not even to get into politics or anything else, but the populace, the nationalism, like we need to take care of ourselves. We're part of a globe. I mean, you can't you can't separate yourself from everybody else, even if you wanted to. We are all part of this one system, and it goes beyond our country. It goes beyond our earth. It goes into the whole universe itself. We are all part of a connected system that's moving and influencing all around. And I see that as I look back over the long past that I've had in those different interactions. So, yeah.
I really appreciate who you are, and I appreciated your first point about opportunity, because I think in my mind that connects to invitation, and it's almost like you have to be able to see things as an opportunity or an invitation. And I think that's what's really powerful about who you are, is that you accept the invitation and you're up for the adventure. And I just really love that about you. Not knowing you at all. I appreciate that about you.
That's funny. One of my favorite movies, and it got me through, I don't want to say it got me through, but it was one of the things I enjoyed when it was a tough time in my life, was a Jim Carrey movie called Yes Man. Because, again, I'm a huge introvert, and when things are going wrong, my natural inclination is to just hide. I don't want to talk to anybody. I don't want to go anywhere. I don't want to do anything. And no is absolutely the very fastest thing that will ever come out of my mouth. And so as I'm watching that movie and I'm listening to, and obviously it got into the absurd of him saying yes to just really dumb things, but that was kind of the point. That was the idea. Just get out of your rut, get out of your regular whatever, and experience something different. And at my best, that's what I'm doing. I'm not, you know, obviously I don't say yes to everything, but I try to say yes to a lot with that same philosophy in mind of that's where goodness lies. That's where wisdom comes from. That's where experience is born, is from saying yes to things that we don't know how it's going to go. Because if we did, we'd just be able to predict it and talk about it. But I appreciate you saying that.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I think there's a lot of people that maybe see the invitation and they run screaming in the other direction. And now we know that you do not do that.
Not all the time. No, I can't say that I haven't and that I won't again, but I try to say yes, and I try to lean into the different opportunities.
Listeners, I hope you loved and appreciated this gentle reminder that when you're in the flow of the world, when you're close to the soul of the world talks back to you. The world speaks back to you. And while Brian does have a different version, a different interpretation of the events that have happened in his life, you know me. I'm going to look at it through my lens and say, hey, someone or something has Brian's back, and for that, I'm really grateful. The work that he's doing in this world is helping so many people that it's bound to make this world a more beautiful place. To read up a little bit more about Brian and his work and the way he moves in the world, well, there will be a link in the episode's show notes. So do yourself a favor and do a deeper dive on just who this human being is. I want to thank all of you for listening. And remember, ratings and reviews are where it's at. So you know what? Pause right now. Go to wherever you listen and give me a rating or write a little review. Those ratings and reviews mean so much, and they help other people find us. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Brian. I mean, I got the sense that Brian is in this life for the adventure. For the adventure and for showing up and for the invitation, for what's on offer. I mean, Brian really recognizes the invitation. He's aware of it. Brian knows that it's an opportunity. So be like Brian and show up in this world looking for those invitations. Looking and recognizing those opportunities, because I am telling you, once you accept the invitation, once you see that opportunity and you say yes, your life, well, it's never going to be the same. And go out on a great big adventure knowing that you have been invited by the magic by those beings behind this universe to create something beautiful. And we need more beauty in this world, everyone. And I just kind of envision all of you going out there and accepting these invitations and recognizing the synchronicities and becoming this powerhouse, this army, I hate that word, but this army of people working with the universe, working with those old gods, working with the magic, and creating a world that is so much more gorgeous, so much more beautiful for every single creature on this planet. You're going to change everything. So get to it, everyone. Look for those invitations.